Hi, I'm Louis Nichols, and you're listening to the Sales for Founders interview series, where each week you can learn all of the sales skills you'll need to find your first customers and to grow a profitable business, directly from the mouths of some of the most successful founders and sales experts out there. This week, I'm super excited to talk to Dani Mancini. Dani is an expert copywriter and she's the solo founder of Scribbly.io, a productized copywriting service which she grew from nothing to tens of thousands of dollars of revenue in just a few months. There's a load of great actionable advice in today's interview. We're going to talk about finding your first customers, about how to deal with burnout and the stress of being a founder, and you'll get some awesome copywriting tips to improve your emails and your landing pages. Also, check out the show notes for an exclusive 25% Sales for Founders discount off everything on Scribbly.io. Right, let's dive in. Dani, it's great to have you here. Why don't you kick us off by telling us a bit about yourself, about Scribbly, and how that all got started?
Yeah, sure. So as you already said, my name's Dani and I am originally from the UK, but a few years ago left a life in London to come and kind of live on the continent for a bit, just to kind of have a bit of a change of scenery. And now I live in Copenhagen. And I think kind of that process of moving from London to Copenhagen was actually like a really kind of character defining, or at least business defining experience for me. And sort of since that time, I have set up my first company, which is called Scribbly, and it's a subscription based copywriting service, which was born out of a very, very kind of unexpected transition from being a freelancer into being a business owner, which I'll talk you through throughout this interview.
Awesome. So maybe we can dive straight into that now, just to give listeners a rough idea of where Scribbly is today and how it started. So can you tell us where you are now and when you started and kind of give us a really rough overview of that journey?
Yeah, sure. So as it stands today, Scribbly is currently, I just checked before this interview actually, and we've currently got 25 active subscriptions. All of different price ranges. I think I'll go into this in a bit more detail later on, but one of the challenges is that I try to have a really simple business model, in that all packages, all subscriptions are exactly the same price, and actually no, I don't have a single customer that is on the kind of base level product, but everybody's on varying price points. They have their own kind of bespoke package, which means currently, this month anyway, the projected income, like not profit, just revenue of the business is just over $18,000. So it's growing very, very nicely. The business officially started in August last year. However, I'd been working and building up a client base as a solo freelancer from around April last year. So it's a pretty much, let's call it like a year old, or a year since the very inception of the business. So yeah, within 12 months, that's kind of money-wise, that's where it's got to. But I think more than that, there's been a really interesting kind of process of shifting from being, like initially my core focus was just on chasing as much revenue as possible. And one of the things that I found very, very kind of, I think quite surprisingly, was that the more I increased revenue, the more actually my profits were starting to take quite a big nosedive. So over very sort of recent months and recent weeks, actually, I've been kind of putting the brakes on a little bit in terms of growth, so that I can focus on how to optimize all of the processes, all of the things that are in place to make sure that everything is as efficient as possible. Because I think the challenge that I faced coming from doing this process of shifting from being a freelancer into running a business, where I effectively project manage and oversee lots of other writers doing work, is that the business was it wasn't designed like a product. It was designed like a one person service. And as you scale, that becomes like increasingly challenging. Now I'd say we're in a sort of new sort of phase of Scribbly, which is really thinking about how to transform, like I've always called it a productized service right from the very beginning, but how to actually build it like a product rather than a service.
Yeah, great. So I think that's something that a lot of people out there, there'll be a lot of developers, designers, copywriters out there who would be really interested in maybe starting their own productized service or going from a service into more of a product route. So yeah. What I'd love to kind of dive into is how you, well, let's start off by just talking about how you got that very first customer. Can you go into some real detail of Danny's sitting there with a, you know, successful kind of consulting freelance client base, and what made you decide to go into more of a productized route, and how did you get that first customer to sign on?
Yeah, so when I was working as a freelance writer, freelance copywriter, I noticed that so many of the people that I was working with, clients that I was working with, their biggest pain point was just they tended to be small businesses with an injection of cash, usually because they'd just raised some money and they finally had the sort of capacity financially and both resource-wise to pursue things like content marketing, better campaigns, etc. Their main pain point was just needing high volume of really excellent quality copy producing in order to meet the demands of all of the experiments that they wanted to run in-house. And by experiments, I mean like marketing activities that they had decided they wanted to try out. And that could be anything from producing a high volume of blog content through to producing very iterative landing page copy, through to testing on search ad copy. Like they had a lot of concurrent things that needed to be done, which tend to require a level of like specialist knowledge in order to do them well, and they just simply didn't have the internal expertise in order to be able to execute on them quickly enough. And there's only so much that one person can help to support. I mean, effectively, I found myself being almost like an in-house, like a remote in-house resource for like lots of different companies, and very, very quickly I started to burn out. And I think actually it's probably not so interesting for your listeners to sort of hear about this side of things, but I do think it's worth touching on the impact that going through like a very, very real and quite damaging burnout process had on me and the decisions that I made from that point onwards.
Because yeah, please.
Like the summer of last year anyway, I was just totally struggling. Couldn't find the headspace, energy, or just like mental capacity to do a good job on anything anymore. And it was making me increasingly anxious, increasingly stressed out. And all of a sudden I felt like I couldn't work. So I just decided to stop, basically. And I kind of stopped every single copy job that I was doing at the time, because I just felt that I was kind of headed down a path that was just not a good one. So during that, I had a very, very brief sort of couple of weeks where I just took some time out to like reflect, have a think about what was both important to me from a personal perspective, like in terms of what kind of professional life I wanted to have, and also like what I'd learned about the businesses that I was working with and where there was a lot of value to be had for them. And I realized during that time that it wasn't having, like their main pain point was not being able to find good quality resource on demand. And my main pain point was wanting to be able to support and consult these businesses through these amazing journeys that they were on, but not necessarily wanting to be the person to do the nitty gritty. And so thankfully, like being a copywriter, you tend to form like very, very nice and supportive networks. There's a lot of, especially when you work remotely, you kind of latch onto these communities that are online of people who are also working in that freelance copywriting space. And so I just reached out to some of the people that I'd either worked with whilst being a freelancer, all people that I knew had a really good reputation, and kind of said, hey, I'm thinking of doing this thing. It would basically work like, you know, it's kind of gig economy based. You are effectively still working as a freelancer, except I just source all of your business and manage the whole process. You don't have to interact with a client. You don't have to think about where your next project is coming from. I'll just kind of make sure that you have regular ongoing work, and you just have to execute. Don't have to worry about all of the other stuff. And so, and that kind of was actually quite appealing to a lot of copywriters, because it can be a bit of a difficult marketplace out there, and you know, looking for new work is just as time consuming as actually doing the work. So the offer of being able to kind of have a stream of clients without having to necessarily go out and find them was quite appealing. And on the flip side, I then went to some of the clients that I had been working with as a freelancer, who I knew still had this like big demand. And I was saying, like, I am now shifting into this new model, and I can guarantee the quality because I'm still going to be overseeing every single piece of content that you get. It's just I won't be the one producing it. But on the flip side, you will have access to way more quality and, well, not quality, I like to think that was quite, I was good quality to begin with, but that more volume of quality writers without having to do anything. And so I at that time was working with, I think I contacted maybe like 14, 15 clients that I'd worked with, and seven of them expressed a very strong interest in at least trying it out. So, and that was all just done through, you know, very personal emails, very much like, I think one of the big things I've always tried to do from the very beginning of Scribbly is to be the face of the company and like make my personal story and my personality be very much part of the service. Like, I want people to feel that they're not interacting with a business, but that they're interacting with an individual who is down to earth and whatnot. So that's always kind of been the communication method and the brand that I've tried to explore. And so, but from the very beginning, it was just, you know, manual outreach, really like not trying to make it seem better or more established than it was, but being very real and saying like, hey, trying this out, I think it could be really interesting, and let's give it a go at a reduced cost so you can at least see if it works for you, and if it doesn't, no stress, let's just, you know, call it quits. And if it does, well, then we can explore how that might turn into a ongoing subscription. And I think because the pain point is so strong that people really do have a hard time finding good quality writers that they can trust and not have to spend loads of time then editing the work or doing all of that back and forth. Actually, a lot of people they latched onto that offer quite quickly. So there wasn't, unfortunately, like a very magic formula that I went through. It was really just like answering a very, very tangible problem that people had with an easy solution that didn't require any more from them.
Yeah, that's great. That makes a lot of sense. There's a load of stuff to unpack there. If we go back to the beginning, I think it's not directly related to sales, like you said, but it's something that I think a lot of people could, or a lot of people listening could definitely profit from, is when you're talking about having this burnout, and obviously you handled it pretty well and you rebounded pretty quickly, but could you maybe, looking back now, did you see some warning signs of what got you there in the first place? Something that maybe some of the people listening might want to avoid?
Yeah. I definitely waited too long before doing something about it. Actually, there weren't even warning signs. There were like screaming sirens that I just ignored. Because I think one of the big challenges that you face when you decide to go self-employed, or if you know you're doing something on the side, is you're struggling with this anxiety of where your next paycheck is going to come from. And I come from prior to doing any of this, I was always in very, very stable and secure jobs. I've never really done anything risky. And I was just so scared that that times are good, but maybe they wouldn't always be good. So I just kept taking on more and more and more work and getting more and more and more tired and pulling more and more and more all-nighters. And eventually there were days where, like, whole weeks where my one sort of objective for that day was to just not break down. I was just kept having these massive freakouts at my computer and just feeling like I couldn't really do anything, couldn't work, and I couldn't think clearly, and I just kept crying basically, because I was totally overwhelmed and I was just working myself too hard. And instead of the first time that happened thinking, this isn't like me and I've never done this before and maybe something is a bit out of sync, I instead just ploughed on and on and on. And I did that for a few months until one day I just couldn't do it anymore, and I had to basically stop everything, when actually a much more sensible thing to have done would have been to kind of gradually ease the workflow down to a more manageable level rather than having to go from like 1,000 to zero because I'd pushed it too far. So I think like a really important thing for anybody who's trying to go through some kind of business building process and is feeling some of those anxieties, maybe not as strongly as I was, but to some extent it's always there, is to really listen in to what your body is telling you. And I don't mean that in a kind of woo-woo way. I do mean genuinely just like accepting sometimes you have to pause or you have to slow down, and not feeling guilty about that, but actually accepting that that's the most responsible thing that you can do for your business. And in the long run, it will massively pay dividends. So I think, just listen in, tune in to what your physical and mental health is telling you that you're able to do at that moment in time, because it won't always be like that. Like, even if you need a week or 2 weeks where you're just like taking it much more slowly, maybe the next month you'll be fired up and doing like a crazy amount because you'll be super energized. So I think just allow yourself to go through that roller coaster and trust that on balance it will all be good in the end. It doesn't matter that sometimes it's slower than others, but actually that's a very natural part of the process.
Yeah, that sounds like great advice. I think you see that a lot as well. You see all this all the stories of founders and everything you see on Twitter and on the Indie Hackers and everywhere. There's everyone else seems to be doing really well, so you feel this pressure, and you have to realize pretty much everyone is going through hard times at some point, and it's fine to take a break and to kind of just recoup.
Definitely. And I think one of the things I feel so strongly about is how toxic this kind of hustler mentality can be. And there's this mindset, particularly I think in the States, but also very much in Europe too, of like, you've got to burn that midnight oil. If you're not pushing and pushing, you're not really dedicated to your business. And actually I think it's really toxic, because of course, some personalities, some people can operate like that. They can function on, 4 hours sleep or whatever. And I seriously applaud them. But most people need to have a much more balanced and rounded life in order to be a successful business person, whatever that means to you. And also, for some people, being a successful business owner or entrepreneur or founder, whatever, that might mean making $300 a month. And that's also totally okay. That's also successful. So I think I got sucked up a bit into that mindset of like, got to grind, got to hustle, got to keep doing more. And actually, what I really wanted was to just have a nice life and to have a business that supported me and like enabled me to have a nice life. So you really have to check in with yourself and ask yourself, why are you doing this in the first place? What is your core fundamental objective? Like, is it to be a bajillionaire? If so, amazing, go for it, but just do it sensibly. If it's to just have a really nice lifestyle business that means you can do, 3 hours work a day and 10 hours fun stuff, that's also still really successful. So yeah, I just think it's worth reminding yourself it doesn't have to be all in all the time.
Yeah, that chimes with my experience as well, for sure. So I do want to get back to some of the sales stuff.
Yes.
And something I picked up on right at the beginning, which you said, was it all started with you noticing this pain of smaller startups who just received a funding round and who were basically desperately looking around for some expertise, some help with content and copywriting. And I think there are a lot of people out there who are at that beginning stage and they'd like to start something. Maybe it's a product, maybe it's a service. And they're just struggling to, they know they should be going out and finding a pain or a problem to fix before they build something, but they're just sitting there going, look, how do I do this? How do I find this pain? So you remember kind of, how did you know, basically, how did you know that there was this market for what you were doing?
That's a good question. And I think my answer might be a little bit unpopular, but I think it really boils down to, like, especially for the first time round anyway, first thing you do, it really helps to do, to start something in a industry or a sector or a field or whatever that you really understand, that you're totally in the right mindset for, like, you understand empathetically what it means to be on the, you know, on the set, the recipient, the person you're trying to sell to. I'd been both a freelance copywriter, but I'd also been in-house trying to find good freelance copywriters. So I was almost like my target audience. I was my target customer in some ways. And the people that I try and sell to now are kind of like, I've been in their shoes. So, and that's both from the writer's perspective, but also from the business's perspective, or the, you know, the decision maker's perspective in the businesses that I work with. So I think it really, really helps to try and design a business where you're your first customer, because you then, it's inevitable that when you're building something, you make so many assumptions about what people want or what's important to them or what kind of message would resonate with them. And, you know, you can only really validate that by going through the process of building something. And that takes time, but you can kind of squish that time down a little bit if you can really identify with what it is that you're trying to solve, because you're somehow involved in it. So yeah, I think, like, that's probably key to why Scribbly took off so quickly in the way that it did, was because I wasn't like trying to find a problem. I was like deep in the problem, and I just decided to figure out a solution. And I know that's not always possible, especially, you know, tech solutions can be, like, it is still a human driven business, what I do. If you have a you know, a tech first business, of course that is a bit more tricky to do, because you can't go all in day one with a solution. That does take time, but still fundamentally trying to design for yourself as your first customer by truly fundamentally understanding that pain point as if it was your own, I think that makes a massive difference.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely spot on. That makes a lot of sense. So moving forward from there, you have this pain point that you really understand, which is amazing, because then not only do you understand the pain point, but you understand the words that the customers will use to talk about it. You understand the objections they'll have. You basically understand everything that they're going through, right? You understand why they'll buy, why they won't buy. So moving on from there, that first customer that you got on board, they were a previous consulting client, right? Can you go, like, really into kind of granular detail of what did you do? How did you decide what to reach out to them with? Was that an email? Was that a call? How long did it take for them to sign up? All this kind of stuff. Just as much detail as you want.
Yeah, okay, cool. So one of my very first customers, in fact, it was my first subscription customer, was basically someone who runs an edtech company in the UK called The Tale Unfolds, and they have a kind of secondary business, which is called Lit Film Fest. And basically they design tech resources to use in schools to teach literacy. And it's an amazing company with, like, two people running in a product that's now in, like, hundreds of schools all over the UK. So I knew that this was a very, okay, so step number one was looking through my client list and really honing in on who are the people in that pool of individuals who meet the assumptions I have about who this product will be interesting to. And A Tale Unfolds was a really good example of that, because it was two people with, like, so much to do. And I knew that they'd also just had an injection of funding, or it was like partnership funding, to deliver on a huge new project. So it was kind of like they were perfect. They were exactly in the prime scenario that Scribbly helps to support you with. So I just reached out to a number of people who fit that profile, but this was, I think, one of the ones where it was really, like, you know, the timing was perfect. and said, hey, don't know if this is interesting. I've just reached out. I've just started this new business and it does X, Y, Z. And I think it will be interesting you because you've told me, and then fill in the blank of, you know, the pain that they've told me about that I know is true. And finally, signing it off with, you know, I think realistically it will cost X amount in order to deliver Y. And it was maybe like a 6-7 line email, very, very short, very to the point, but also like very personal as well. And, you know, absolutely tailored for every single person that was emailing. And that, I think, within a day or two, they were on board. And we basically helped. Again, it was, you know, a case of really good timing, but they'd also just, the founder had just received some funding to write a book. You have to think about each and every customer as an individual use case. Like, of course, you can, as a productized service, you need as much as possible to have generalized things that you offer, and it needs to be a fairly generalized service in order for it to work. However, you have to think of each and every customer completely separately from the others, and to think about how you can tinker tailor like what they're doing to what you're doing, and make those two parts marry nicely. Because one of the areas where productized services, I think, can really fall short is that feeling of it not being personalized, and that it being a kind of catch-all solution, when actually very few businesses can function with a catch-all solution, especially when it comes to services like copywriting. So you have to, I think, always be really mindful of what you need to do at a very human level to make it feel still like a human service, even if it is on some level that, you know, you're offering the same package to a lot of people. So I think that was an important learning for me.
That makes sense. I'd like to get back to, so you said you reached out with that very personalized kind of 6-7 line email to these customers, and you had someone sign on the next day. Can you maybe break it down a bit more for people who've never done any sales at all? Was that then that email you sent out, were you asking them to sign something to confirm the email? Was that for a call? Was the next step? You know, just go through all those touch points you had with the customer, basically until either they paid or until there was a contract signed or something like that. That'd be great.
Totally. Yeah. Really good point. Yeah. So basically in the email, the main call to action that I had sort of centered the email around was for them to sign up for a call, because I felt that would be quite an important or effective conversion mechanism for this kind of service. So I had signed up for a tool called Calendly, which is quite a popular free meeting scheduling tool, which anyone can sign up for. And you can, it's actually a really great tool that I would strongly recommend looking into if you haven't heard of it already. And basically, so I signed off the end of the email. Actually, I put it in there a few times. I think once at the beginning and once at the end, just saying like, I'd love to talk you through what this would mean in practice in a bit more detail. Book in a time that works best for you using this link. And it was, that was all I wanted them to do. So yeah, it was at the first instance getting them from that email to sign up for a phone call, and then of course following on with a phone call as quickly as possible. And you know, one of the things you might find is that people tend to book in for a call, maybe they don't show up for the call, maybe they keep rescheduling the call. So you need to have, at that point, I didn't do this and I wish I had have done it, I do it now, but have an automated sequence of emails that you can follow up with people on to make sure that if they haven't responded to that first email, that they'll get another email without you having to kind of manually go through that process a couple of days later. Or if they reschedule a call, that they get an automatic email saying like, hey, I noticed you rescheduled the call, no worries, I know how things are, life's busy, here's the link again to book in another call. I didn't have that done then. And I think if I had have done, I would have converted a ton more people. I'm actually like a bit, it's quite funny now to say, but back then I literally didn't log my contacts anywhere. It was just in my inbox. It's hilarious to think like I really had no idea what I was doing back then. So yeah, my number one tip is seriously right at the very beginning, get a CRM system. There are so many. I think the free HubSpot one does a really good job if you don't know anything about CRMs and you've never used them before, it's they're all not super intuitive, but this tends to be kind of user-friendly for beginners. And also it has a lot of bolt-on functionality that can be really helpful as you scale. So definitely make sure before you send any of those emails that you're logging your contacts and tagging them and making deals that you can then track right from the very beginning, because I didn't. And I think I lost out a lot probably because I didn't do that.
Yeah, that's great advice. So getting back to that call that you said, so you have them from the email to the call. Can you give a rough idea of, you know, what is one of those calls like? Is that 10 minutes, half an hour? And, you know, what's the next step after that? If assuming, you know, they keep in touch, they're interested, are you sending them out like a physical contract? Is that a PDF? Is that just, you know, just how do, I think a lot of people can get to this stage. And yeah, then they assume the work's done, and then all of a sudden they don't have a customer. So can you kind of go through the closing part of this part?
Yes. So I found that the shorter I keep the phone call, the more people sign up for them. So I tend to just send people a link for a 15-minute phone call. And then if somebody during that phone call says, yeah, that sounds really interesting, I'd like to give it a try, what I'll do is immediately follow up with you know, what we've discussed on the phone, including the price that we've agreed. I always offer a trial price because I think it's, you know, we talked a little, you touched upon objection handling before, but, you know, one of the biggest objections to trying out anything new is this going to be a waste of money? Is this worth my investment? So I try and make it as cost effective and not cost limiting as possible for people to try Scribbly out without feeling like if they don't like it, they've wasted loads of money. So yeah, follow on with an email basically saying, this is what we've talked about and let's get started right away. And I, in my case, need them then to send me a brief. So what that email will also do is the main call to action is like, please fill in this brief and I'll get it signed out right away. And I have a link to an online form where people submit briefs. Again, now I have a email sequence to follow that people are busy and they don't always, you know, remember to do stuff right away. So I just give them a gentle nudge a day later, then 3 days later. And then like now I have 4 emails in total basically saying like, hey, we, you know, let's get this show on the road kind of thing. You know, you have to accept that even though someone expresses interest, sometimes the timing's just not right. So if somebody doesn't reply after email number 4, I then enroll them in another email sequence, which is 30 days later. I call them at that point a lost contact. If they, you know, this is if they literally don't reply, right? If they don't reply at all to anything, I assume that timing's just not right, and I'll send something that is called quite commonly in email lingo, whatever, a breakup email. And in that email, I'll say like, hey, I'm tried to reach out a few times. I don't want to pester you. Just assume that right now is not the right time to try Scribbly, but in the meantime, here's some useful resources that I think could be interesting for you. And I'll then just say like, I'll follow on in a few weeks or in a month or something with just to see if anything's changed. So I'll then enroll them in a sequence that triggers 30 days after the last contact and offer them a promo at that point. So I'll say, and I'll give that promo, I'll make it time limited. So it'll be like, hey, you know, for the next, I'll try and say something that reflects that there are lots of people doing this and that you're kind of missing out by not doing it. So I'm going to say something along the lines of, if you're anything like the other customers that or clients, whatever, that we're working with at Scribbly, you're probably doing some amazing stuff right now. Is there anything that we can help you with? If so, here's 35% off your next project. If you sign up within the next, or if you send over a brief within the next 5 days, something like that. And then over the course of that next 5 days, I will just, you know, that they'll get an email after 2, 3, and then 5 days just to remind them, to try and nudge them to fill in that brief if they're still interested. And yeah, I mean, you have to accept that a lot of people just probably won't do it because they've changed their mind or they're not interested or they found another solution, and that's also okay. And I've learned to become much more selective about who is a customer now. Like, really, what I found is that the kind of customer who is a good one for Scribbly, if they're gonna sign up, they're gonna do it basically straight away. And if they don't, they're probably not going to. So I try not to invest too much time and effort after that initial period where we're talking about a project and trying to get them to sign up. If they don't do that initial trial, it's quite unlikely that they're going to magically kind of change their mind. That's just what I found anyway. Whereas people who with a high conversion intent or a high purchase intent, they will just do it immediately because they have the need then there, and they just want to get going, and they're interested to find out if this is what it is cracked up to be. So whereas before I was putting a lot of effort into, I was basically like losing money on clients that were never ever ever going to become subscription customers, now I don't worry too much about it.
Yeah, that's really interesting, the lead qualification side of things, which obviously at the beginning you're just going through and thinking, okay, these are 100 companies that possibly could work with me. Some of them definitely would be ideal customers. And of those, maybe one or two might even be interested in being like an early adopter and trying it out. And I think in the early days, you shouldn't be thinking, how many of these 100 can I convert? You should be thinking, yeah, how quickly can I find the one of these 100 who is the right person for me right now?
Exactly. Yeah.
So when you, obviously after the first couple of customers you got on board, via your kind of your network, your client list from your consulting and stuff like that, how did you go about, which you touched on, you know, how did you go about kind of qualifying those leads and, you know, just finding more of the right kind of lead to reach out to? How do you get maybe, let's say, customer number 15 or 20? How is that different to the first couple of customers?
Yeah. So in the beginning, I was doing a lot of outreach, going to places where I thought my customers were and doing campaigns, creating landing pages, doing stuff to try and get them to give us a go. Those tended to be, got a lot of interest because we were offering a huge discount at that time. People kind of wanted to just get free content, which, yeah, was a really poor use of my time. So now I have stopped doing that completely. And I now, actually, the business grows a lot through word of mouth, because the ideal Scribbly customer tends to want to put people in touch. You know, the people who they put us in touch with tend to be very, very similar to them in similar circumstances. So they also tend to be very, very good leads. And so I offer all of our customers a referral, a rewards program. The people that they refer who go on to become paying customers, they get credit towards their account, which can grow indefinitely. And I actually find that a lot of people want to do it just because they know people who they care about who are have a similar pain point that they would like to help out. So they're not, I think the reward is nice to have, but it's, I don't think why people do it. So now I think the key answer here is just like focusing effort and not trying to scattergun do everything. Initially I was like, oh my God, I should do paid advertising. Oh my God, I should like go on Indie Hackers and do loads of, this is actually a really good example. So you featured before Pat Wells, who from Starter Story. So I did an interview on Starter Story, which Pat promoted on Reddit, and it was amazing. I had like, I'm not joking, more leads than I've ever had from that Reddit feature. And not one of them turned into anything. Or maybe one or two perhaps, but mostly of the over 100 people who contacted about Scribbly, most just wanted free content, which we did, of course. Like, you know, that was the offer. We were offering like $100 free credit, so they got very, very cheap content. But I knew with absolutely no intention of ever then becoming paying subs. So, and you know, the knock-on effect of that was that I had to actually get somebody, like an assistant, a customer support person, to help me manage that volume of leads and to project manage the production of all of that content. And I lost a lot of money from it. And it was a total, the exposure, the PR aspect was brilliant. I just hadn't thought through the next step of it. I hadn't thought, okay, what do I want? How do I qualify the people who are interested? Like, what offer makes sense for this target audience? You know, I just hadn't thought it through. And I think that was a real learning for me, to just not rush into doing too much, but actually like really plan it out before going into any kind of campaign or whatever.
And how do you do that differently now?
I think I'm just much more selective about, so I try and really profile audiences much more than I did before, create very clear personas for specific campaigns. And then like I've actually stopped running any kind of landing page promotion or anything for now, because what I now want to do is make those, when they run, make those landing pages hyper personalized. So really, you know, we've talked about this before, about having copy that really resonates with wherever they've clicked from. Let's say it's Reddit, like having a very Reddit specific landing page that makes it clear who this service is for. Like, it's not just a catch-all, like, we do everything, if you need copy, come get it, but more specific use cases that resonate with that Reddit target audience, and then an offer that makes sense. So maybe not giving away any prices at the beginning, but rather saying, these are the proven results we've had for people just like you. If you're interested, get in touch. Like, so it's more selling the output rather than the, like, I was very price focused before, and now I'm trying not to be, basically, I think is the answer.
Yeah, brilliant. So I guess moving on from there then, it wouldn't make sense to have someone who, you know, has a lot of copywriting experience kind of on the podcast and not talk about kind of some copywriting mistakes or improvements that founders can make in the early days. Do you have kind of off the top of your head, let's say I'm an early stage founder, I've got somewhere between maybe zero and 15 customers. What are some mistakes I may be making, and what are some kind of quick, effective copywriting tips that I should take on board and kind of use today, tomorrow to make things run more smoothly?
So definitely one of the biggest things that I see happening a lot is small businesses communicating about the business from the business's perspective. So they'll say stuff like, we do this, or we offer X, or whatever. And you always have to remember, basically, never to do that. You always have to, whatever service you're offering, think about it as a solution to a lived problem. So every time you communicate your offering, do so from the user's perspective. Talk about how, you know, what you fix, what lived experience, what lived pain point your problem fixes, none of us can do in the same way. So a good exercise to kind of to do that is to, every time you say we, replace it with you and reframe the sentence. So yeah, it's a difficult thing to do, because it's really difficult when you've been working with something intensely by yourself to kind of step out of your perception of the business and think about it from your users. But it's so critical. So definitely that, make sure that you're speaking using the pronoun you every time you're kind of instinctively going to we. Just remember that, always need to make sure that your copy, wherever it is, email, landing page, advert, whatever, clearly and explicitly and immediately says what's in it for the user. And you're not going to do that by saying we, what you do. So, okay, rule number one, do that. Second thing is always to really, this is a really hard thing to do, but to cut down whatever you're saying or writing by like 50% every time, because I guarantee, even though it seems like you're losing essential detail, you're making your message clearer by doing so. And it is hard, because every word is precious to you, everything that you have put in there, you've done so for a reason, but you've got to try and kind of condense that down into the simplest possible message for your user, reader, whatever, so that they understand immediately what it is that you do, and there's absolutely no element of confusion in that. So Yes, make it shorter, and usually make it 50% shorter, and then if you can, make it 50% shorter again, especially in emails, but also on landing pages too. And then I would say I see a lot of copy that we work with that we're asked to rework. It doesn't address objections at all. So there's something in copywriting, or not just copywriting, there's just a thing called objection handling, which is basically like, how do you counteract all of the things that would make your user, your reader, not want to convert? And usually these are things like, you know, it's too expensive, I'm not the right person, I'm too busy for this, or I don't really get it, whatever. You can counteract a lot of those potential objections by speaking directly to them. So, for example, let's say you've got some kind of tech product and you are trying to tell people, maybe your target audience is like somebody who's not usually a very technically literate customer base. You then would speak to them directly and say that, you know, this product works even if you've never worked with this technology before. Saying something like "even if" says to the user, you know, we're literally mirroring that kind of uncertainty that you have in your mind, and we're speaking directly to it. So, yeah, definitely try as much as possible to think of all of the things that could potentially stop someone from converting, what their objections might be, and then directly address them head on. And that is a very, very, very effective and I would say essential technique to work into any copy that you do. Make sure that you've really thought about copy as a holistic thing. So not just like one landing page on its own, but as one, that landing page, where does it fit into a whole journey, like a whole communication journey? So let's say someone's clicked on an ad. Does that landing page then fit where they've clicked from? And this is something that a mistake that people of every level of expertise, I think, make. I've done it. I probably continue to do it sometimes. If somebody clicks on an ad, let's say to use the Reddit example, they've clicked from Reddit. Why then land on a landing page that doesn't talk about Reddit in any way? It's almost like there's been a massive disconnect. And you want people to feel like you're taking them through a very thought through and personalized and tailored journey that speaks specifically to them. And if you have mapped out your communication and your messaging across every single touch point with, you know, very specific personalized words and mentions, you're much more likely to do that. So definitely try and be conscious of where you can make something a smoother flow by just mirroring, you know, if they've come from an ad, make sure that landing page then says something that relates to that ad. And if they go into an email flow after signing up on that landing page, make sure that email flow speaks directly to what they've seen and heard and read or whatever on the landing page. And all of these things make people feel more secure and ultimately more likely to convert.
A lot of people will want to kind of to improve their copywriting, or they just don't feel very, very, very good at it, because it is something you have to practice. It's not something that necessarily comes naturally to everybody, and it's not necessarily something that everyone likes to do. So can you maybe, do you have a couple of recommendations of where people can go to either to learn more or to improve their copywriting? And also, what's the right kind of point in let's say in a startup or a project's journey when they should start thinking about working with an expert or outsourcing some of this to someone like, or to something like Scribbly?
Okay, so on the first point, there are lots and lots, almost like an overwhelming amount of resources online. You can go to the Scribbly website. We have a knowledge base. You can have a look on there for kind of tips and tricks on how to kind of approach copy in-house in a straightforward way. You know, also it depends a little bit on exactly what it is that you're trying to improve your copy for. There are loads of amazing resources, like HubSpot have an amazing knowledge base. Neil Patel has an amazing blog, like Universe, which is just full of incredible resources on how to write better, especially emails and landing pages. And then I would say just read a lot of content that you like and try and think about what makes it so successful and what you could, what elements of it you could work into your own copy. Because a lot of what makes good copy boils down not just to the use of language, but also to the brand and the tone of voice that you are trying to create. So like definitely spend time, doesn't have to be too in depth, but think about your tone of voice, like write it down, say what it is clearly in like, you know, a few bullet points, what kind of characteristics your brand tone of voice has, and try and make it feel very alive, because then you'll have some consistency. Copy is not words. It's not like, it's not just the use of the English language. It's a story about it's your story. You know, you've been building something that is a really epic journey that you're going on as a founder. And you want to make sure that how you're communicating that journey is really on point, because it does you a disservice for it not to be. So, and just because you know, you're an English speaker or you've written a couple of things in the past doesn't necessarily mean that you're the best person to craft that story. So getting some external help can be a really, really valuable exercise and such a good return on investment. And then, of course, as soon as you start to think about scaling your activity, whether that's campaign activity or whether that's blog content, it doesn't really matter. I think any business of any size, especially smaller businesses, really need to maximize your efficiency. And sitting down and writing content, you know, blog content is not an efficient use of time usually. It can take someone who's not an experienced writer maybe a day or more to do a single blog post. And that's a day or more that you're not doing other things that have really big, you know, an important value for the business. So outsourcing those activities which are easily outsourced with the right partner can just save you so much time and can really help you to scale kind of exponentially according to whatever your demand is. So I definitely think there's no one single point where it makes like the most sense, but there are definitely periods in your journey and your growth that it for sure makes you more efficient and makes you able to better focus your resources by outsourcing, and those tend to be right at the beginning and at that moment where you're scaling but you haven't yet got the resources in-house to scale the activities.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Great. So firstly, before I have one more question, but before we get to that, I'm sure people will be interested to find out more about you and your journey and Scribbly. So mm-hmm. where can they go and find out more about you, or maybe send you a question or a comment or whatever?
Yeah, you're welcome to contact me on Twitter. You can find me at Danny_Scribbly, or you can just head to scribbly.io and send an email there, or you can just email me at Danny@scribbly.io, whatever you prefer. And I will happily and gladly help out with any questions that you have. And it's like, copy can be a confusing space because it seems like something that should be simple, and actually the more you get into it, it tends to be not the case.
Awesome. And I'll stick the links in for that in the show notes. So thanks a lot, Danny. It's been great. Before I let you go, I know you have to jump off in a couple of minutes. Is there one piece of advice? Doesn't have to be copy related necessarily, but there's a for a founder who's starting out today, who's trying to find their first customer, is there one piece of advice that you wish you'd had that you'd give them?
I would say, I think it would be your first customer. Design a solution that you need, that you would use, and you can't go far wrong because you'll be designing the right thing then. And I think that's like a really worthwhile mindset to have, especially at the very beginning.
Awesome. Well, it worked for you. Danny, thanks a lot. That was super exciting. I'm excited to see where Scribbly goes in the future. And I'm sure we'll hear a lot more from you and maybe have you on again to talk more in depth about some of this copywriting stuff. Thanks a lot. Have a great day. And yeah, thanks.
Thank you so much.
That's it for this episode of the Sales for Founders podcast. We'll be back next week with another interview, finding out how amazing founders acquire their first customers and grow profitable businesses by doing sales. If you're a founder and you're struggling to come up with a product that people want to buy, or maybe you just need a bit of help finding your first customers, then you should head on over to salesforfounders.com. And if you enjoyed the show, please take a few seconds and leave a rating or a review in the podcast app of your choice. Thanks, and see you next week.